Hello, my name is Tiffany Pinneman. It is January 31st, and we're here at the Zora Festival in Eatonville, Florida, and I'm with Dr. Michelle Berger. And I would like to get started. So just tell me a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in Afrofuturism.
So I am a scholar of women's and gender studies and have been writing creative work for a long time, probably 25 years, more than that. But really, in terms of getting sort of published and being better known for my creative work, has come in the last 10 years. And I have a funny relationship to Afrofuturism, because when I was writing or starting to write in the 90s, I knew Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney, but I really thought, and I'm 51, so I really thought that at that time I was one of the only black people who wrote science fiction or was interested in. And when I would go to science fiction conventions, there really weren't a lot of people who looked like me. And it was Niecy Shaw, who's a really wonderful writer, well-known writer. She happened to be working at the Seuss bookstore. I was a graduate student at University of Michigan, this is in Ann Arbor. And she was like the other person of color I met, and we would talk about things that later got defined as Afrofuturist. I tend to describe my work as extraordinary things that happen to ordinary people.
Nice. And so in your own terms, how would you define Afrofuturism itself, and then how can we apply it to the wider world?
So to me, Afrofuturism is a type of aesthetic. And it questions the way in which canons have been created that depict African descendant people. So mine is really broad. And I think people focus a lot on the futuristic part, as in projecting what are the narratives that are going to sustain black people and people of color in the future. But I think it's also important to recognize that Afrofuturism is also about rethinking the past, right? And providing different kinds of narratives, questioning the tropes that we have used. And that's in arts, politics, literature, visual design, fashion design. I primarily know more about, speculative fiction. So that's kind of where my interest has been, but I feel like people are using it, to answer the second part of your question, people are using it to really think about what are the structures that we have that take away life, right? And that really harm particularly people of color and particularly people of African descent. And what are new ways looking at both creating new forms, but also looking at what certain authors have written to help us think more imaginatively.
And
some of that now is also being reflected in our movies, of course, and to some degree TV. But really, in many ways, it started with music and literature and even politics. And now it is, in some ways, much more mainstreamed.
Mm-hmm. And so going back to what you said about sometimes people think of it mostly as that future side, but rethinking the past, it reminds me of Kindred with Octavia Butler.
Absolutely.
So how would you say that just black women writers have really informed your own writing in terms of this genre and Afrofuturism?
Yeah, I mean, so personally, I feel like I'm very much indebted to the work of black women writers, 20th century black women writers generally. So people like Ntozake Shange, Alice Walker, Pearl Clegg, a number of people who are writing the 80s and 90s. Now, in a more contemporary moment, I do a lot of work and I've come out recently as a horror writer and writer of sort of dark, quote unquote, dark fiction. And so I love the work that's being done by people like Eden Royce, Nicole Kurtz, formerly Nicole Kurtz, she's now Nicole Smith, Linda Addison. I think that really thinking about how women of color are reshaping what is horrific and moving away from this idea of you know, creepy bad things, let's just say, like what, you know, what many of us grew up with in the 80s and 90s of Stephen King, who's a wonderful writer, but looking at the ways in which harassment, sexuality, you know, legacies of slavery, the politics of beauty are have impacted our lives and are horrific and grotesque and worth reconsidering and thinking about. So the collection that came out a couple of years ago, Sycorax's Daughters, which is a collection of prose and poetry primarily by Black women, and they basically take on the horror field. And the work in there is really thinking about also how Black female bodies have been depicted and labeled in certain kinds of ways and taking that on. So I find that, you know, really interesting, as well as, you know, more on the sort of science fiction end, but just in terms of horror, it's been really powerful. And I'll just say one more thing, as someone who, so I was kind of raised in 70s and 80s and watched a lot of horror media, but then more recently went back and kind of reread the classics and reading other new work. And, you know, when I read a lot of majority writers, there's no space for us. We're not often fleshed out as characters in horror, as women of color characters, and we're just not there. Or if we're there, we're either the, you know, the magical Negro, the conjure woman, you know, those kinds of things, right? And so just understanding that, particularly in this space around horror and dark fiction, there's some new exciting work out there by women of color that you're not gonna find in other places.
And me and Kim were having that conversation recently, just about the lack of institutional space for Black women in horror. And so how do you engage in these conversations with your own students? Like, are they doing any interesting work that you're helping them with as well?
So it's so funny, because my PhD is in political science, and I do interdisciplinary work, and I'm in a women's and gender studies department, and it's taken me a long while to figure out how to have a more integrated approach. So my work is on racial and gender health disparities, which can be horrific when we think about systematic inequalities in women of color. But until recently, I haven't really found ways to bring some of that other work as a creative writer, as a creative person. One of the ways it's happened is I teach a Women in Creativity course, upper division course, and in that we look at the ways in which women, as a sort of in the past two centuries, have been excluded, have pushed against ideas of what is, you know, creative and artistic. But I often teach Mind of My Mind by Octavia Butler. And that's actually one that, I mean, now it's kind of back in popularity, but if people have read Octavia Butler, and some of my students have, they are not as familiar with that. And it's just such an interesting novel in so many ways. And so they really love it. So that's one of their entryways. And I also teach, so if I have an opportunity, I also teach some short fiction by, it's kind of feminist speculative fiction writer. So that's one way. But then the other way is not so much on the horror end, but I just, through a big campus-wide initiative, I co-taught a class about the environment and intersectionality, but we use it through a sci-fi lens. And I happen to teach with an African-American female professor in German studies, German and Slavic studies, and an African-American woman professor who was in public health. And we, the three of us, co-taught this class, which was, and think about it, for first year students coming in, all three professors are Black women, and we're all talking about, and we each had sort of our specialties, but we tried to use, how has science fiction represented the environment and what does it tell us about vulnerability? So we looked at like Beast of the Southern Wild and a range of texts. And we got into an Afrofuturist perspective, even though we weren't specifically talking as much about horror. So I feel like the future is kind of bright for trying to, you know, find ways to use the lens of Afrofuturism to talk about disparities or to introduce kind of important concepts to students. And also students are coming with a much wider, you know, visual and reading landscape than they did even 5-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And so, and then when you're thinking about people and writers like Zora Neale Hurston, make those connections between her legacy and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, it's such an honor to be here at this festival. There's so many things going through my mind. To some degree, I think it is the next reclaiming of her work, right? Because Alice Walker wrote in her volume In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, really reintroduced Zora Neale Hurston to both the emerging kind of feminist literary studies as well as to a larger public. But I think now people are recognizing Zora Neale's genius, right, and envisioning to not be afraid of the past and to kind of probe deeply into some tropes and ideas about wider African-American culture. And I think we're now ready, because people, you know, when Zora was writing, people were very othering of her work and ashamed of her work, and I think, you know, now so many writers see her creativity and her genius as part of what this kind of next wave of thinking about both our survival but also kind of our roots. And so it's to me, it's sort of the second reimagining of her work.
And then earlier today, you mentioned that your novel, Renew You, is about Black women saving the world. Could you speak a little bit about that?
It's set in the 1990s, and basically it is, the tagline is, "What if a trip to the salon could kill you?" Mm-hmm. And it imagines a natural hair care product called Renew You that potentially has a virus. And so initially Black women, Latina women who are using it get sick, and doctors sort of dismiss it as a skin rash. And so you follow two protagonists to try to find out what's happening. And so it's got a little bit of the conspiracy theory. It's got a little bit of, you know, this is obviously written before the widespread use of cell phones. So that idea of rumors that circulate. But I wanted to get at the politics of beauty, not so much in saying any one hairstyle or one way of being is wrong, but to make us think about what are the push-pull factors that, you know, create the context for certain kinds of arranging our hair. But it is actually based on a true incident, in that in the 90s, there was a product called Rio, and it was billed as a natural hair care tonic or something out of Brazil. And I play with that idea, and in real life, within 2 or 3 years on the market, there was a class action lawsuit brought by women of color because their scalps were burning. There was actually almost no natural products in it. It had higher percentages of lye and other products, but it was billed under this kind of natural health. And so I sort of took that idea and wanted to play with all of those pieces, and also set the tone of the novella is that it's really about collective female friendship that's going to help the women figure out what's going on. And so often in a lot of, I think, mainstream sci-fi speculative fiction, particularly film and TV, if you have a woman, it's basically a cast of guys, and then there's one woman. Now, and for example, I love Wonder Woman, right? And Wonder Woman was a fantastic film, so many levels, but I'm like, it's basically, you know, she gets excised from her community, and then, you know, she's with these guys. And then it also happens around sort of race and ethnicity, right? So there would be like one person of color in this other ensemble. And I just wanted to kind of play with that ensemble idea. And so for so many Black women and women of color, we have been each other's peer networks, and we've been the witnesses and the guides and the supports. And so I wanted to explore that through female friendship, and also, you know, to some degree counter the narrative that Black women are competitive and jealous. I mean, if you look at the reality TV show landscape, right, mm-hmm. you just see so many ways in which Black women seem to be antagonistic and opposed to each other. So I wanted to play with those, some of those things.
Okay. And that really speaks to just like that element of Black women writers, in terms of how they brought each other's work to prominence in terms of that public discourse. Like Toni Morrison as editor, bringing all of her friends, like revolutionaries, like really memorializing their work too.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I, you know, as you're talking through these questions, I mean, I really have to sort of locate myself in that. I was that person in undergrad in the late 80s, and it felt revolutionary to read Toni Morrison and Alice Walker. I mean, they were just starting to come into the canon in terms of what was acceptable. And also it was often, you know, because I had primarily white female professors who were teaching that work. And I'm so grateful, even though I see different things than they might see in the work, I was so grateful to have that context. And then, you know, of course you go back and you read Gwendolyn Brooks and you read so many people before them, but to have that kind of groundswell, like Toni Kade Bambara and, you know, many, many people who are not as, I think there's been a resurgence, but they're not as well read as they once were, right? And I think we also have to kind of give our due to the people who come before us, which is connected to Zora Neale Hurston, right?
Yes. And so just in your own community in North Carolina, you're at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. What work are you doing in the community as well in terms of connecting people with Afrofuturism, speculative fiction, or Black speculative fiction?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're very privileged to have Toshi Regan, who is an artist in residence, and she, a couple of years ago, adapted Parable of the Sower as an opera. As an opera and kind of a musical production. And one of the things that, so I wasn't directly involved in the production, but in supporting the effort. So Toshi was very strategic in that she wanted, the performance was happening on campus, but prior to that, she wanted to do a series of talks and events in the community, around the community. And she also wanted to upend this idea of, you know, who the Parable of the Sower was for. And that took, she really pushed back on some ideas that the university had of like a kind of a formal event. So as part of that effort, I organized just a conversation about Parable of the Sower with my colleague at the time, Lily Nguyen, who is Vietnamese American, and we held a space at a local bookstore and kind of did a community read, and we talked a lot about some of the mother-daughter themes and Parable of the Sower and some other ways that we wanted people to read the book ideally before they saw the performance, but also other ways we wanted to kind of highlight Butler's work. And so that was really it was really a gift to be with my colleague and see the work through her eyes. And also, so this is like, I think, 2017? So we're still trying to process what the Trump legacy presidency was going to mean, the kind of turmoil that was happening in our community. So it was a powerful time to talk about Parable of the Sower.
Mm-hmm. And that, it reminds me of just like the element of when you said rethinking the past with Afrofuturism, also like what is our past going to look like in the future, so like at our current moment. And so how do you see Afrofuturistic writers right now really shaping our future?
I think one of the, and I, you know, I could be wrong about this, but one of the things that I think buoys people when they come to contemporary Afrofuturist work is that there's a thread of resilience and optimism, and I think we need that. You know, I think it's very, you know, making critiques is a very direct thing right there, especially because there are so many things that seem to be in crisis or being challenged. But what will sustain people really is doing the work of thinking about how do we make strong connections and build community. And even if that community looks slightly different than it does now. And I think that's that's where, to me, where the readers are really resonating with our work, right? And particularly, I would say, on the... Because horror, by its nature, tends to have a much more... I don't want to say just sort of darker, but the sense of... It's cathartic in a different way than I think what kind of traditional science fiction does, which is to kind of move us way, way ahead into the future. So I think some of the writers that are doing that work are... leave those kernels of kind of optimism, right? And so, but we don't know. I mean, it's not clear for our human community where we will be in 20 years, right? We are at such a, I've been trying to read a little bit more what people are calling climate science fiction. Even though people have been writing that for a long time, and you know, we have to ask ourselves pretty deep questions about ourselves as a species, right? And so I think for Afrofuturist folks to try to do that, but also, you know, lay some optimistic seeds in there is really important.
Mm-hmm. And especially around the climate change topic, I know, just with Zora Neale Hurston's fiction, just like her capturing of like that environmental symbolism, her local Everglades and Edenville community, as we see at the festival now, just like that preservation. I made a comment that In Their Eyes Were Watching God, how she documented the actual 1928 Okeechobee Category 5 hurricane.
Oh, right.
So
right.
It's like, even that was like prophetic of our current times, where like hurricanes are growing in frequency and strength. Like they're devastating Caribbean communities. And so like, what does that mean in terms of preserving culture and language and the people's traditions?
Yeah, and it's so powerful, because I had forgotten that there was that piece in her work, for sure. Well, and also what does it mean? I think, so what does it mean to be in an environment? What does that look like? In the class that I talked about earlier, trying to get some students got it, that because of historic inequalities, some of the people most affected by climate change are going to be women, globally, people of color, poor communities, all of that. But then trying, for the students who didn't get that, trying to get them to understand that community may have to be refigured in some new ways, right? Institutions may need to be configured in new ways, was also a challenge. Politics need maybe be reconfigured in some new ways. And I don't know as much about the group in Durham that has been doing emergent strategies. I think they're based in Durham, and I should know more about them. But that's another community that has sort of taken up Octavia Butler's work, and also Toshi Regan's long... So she did The Parable of the Sower, but she's an artist in residence for several more years and wants to really say, have conversations and practices that say, okay, I think the way she frames it is, okay, if things broke down right now, what resources do you have inside of yourself? Just like Lauren from Parable of the Sower, and what resource do you have in your community that you would draw on? So trying to really get people to think about that, mm-hmm. I think is her next project.
Okay.
Which is pretty exciting.
And then I saw that one of your books is Transforming Scholarship, Why Women's and Gender Studies Students Are Changing Themselves in the World. And so how do you see you and your students and your colleagues really playing their role in helping society figure out like what's going to happen when climate change like affects how we survive and coexist together, how gender constructs are refigured and oppressive things hopefully eliminated?
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, that's a great question. So that book was trying to push back on that liberal arts, that skepticism about the liberal arts, like what can you do with this degree? Mm-hmm. So through empirical work, so we did a big global survey, and then we did some interviews, and we saw these patterns that most women's and gender studies students begin broadly defined kind of different levels of activism as students and sort of civic engagement. And then, you know, because we we talk to people 5 and 10 years out, we see how those legacies continue, right? And so some of it is using their critical skills to rethink the workplace, let's just say, or to advocate for gender equality, racial equality in the workplace, but it's also like building better communities. So we are actually able to document that. And I think what's been interesting, so now we're in the process, my collaborator and I are in the process of writing the third edition. And in this one, we're trying to front load so many students who have gone on or interested in the environment and climate change. So we're documenting the rise of, for example, female small local farmers, organic farmers. We're trying to document women in particular, but not exclusively, going into the challenging the ag industry, but also going into biofuels. So we're trying to document all the ways in which people are using their degrees in unexpected ways. And often finding, like, for example, the biofuels industry, it might reflect a kind of, we might say, progressive idea about resources, but the actual day-to-day experiences are highly gendered. And so we have a student, a former graduate, writing about that. Like, what does it mean to use... When people assume, you know, you can't use heavy machinery or you can't do this, or just assume certain ideas about particularly what bodies can do certain things. So so I think in that regard, that's what we get feedback all the time, that that sometimes liberal arts students get sort of pushed into certain kinds of jobs or in the nonprofit area, which there's nothing wrong with that, but to see any job as a job, one that you can bring a gendered analysis to, and a you know, I always say no job is a feminist job, but you can make, you know, feminist thinking a part of any job, but also that the sense of how students or graduates are really pushing down boundaries of like nonprofit versus corporate versus business versus other kinds of versus entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. that the landscape is much wider, much more widely open.
Okay, and then are you interviewing these students, and that's how you're collecting their data, so the qualitative aspect?
So yeah, so we did, the survey has about 900 students,
okay.
graduates in the survey from over 10 years out, and then we did some interviewing from that, and then we have these kind of highlights of career trajectories throughout the book.
Okay.
So yeah, so we're not doing another reboot. After the third edition, then we might do a complete reboot. We would do the survey differently. And
okay.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of Jess Zora Neale Hurston's, like the qualitative aspect of her anthropological work. And so I've also been having some conversations just on the value of different methods. So
absolutely.
Like how qualitative sometimes is kind of dismissed as not valid because it's not like data, like statistics. And so how do you see that in connection to Hurston's work in terms of producing a better or more comprehensive picture of how you can engage in academic work, community work, and activism?
Yeah, so these debates get hardened and solidified depending on where you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in political science, just the name alone suggests that there's one legitimate way to do certain kinds of work. And so most of my career, I've sort of pushed back on those notions. And what I train graduate students in and undergraduates, you want a broad methodological toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the story you want to tell, like if you go to the state legislature and you want to make a case for rapidly moving on DNA rape kits, right? Well, you might need to make an argument that involves, you know, kind of a quantitative argument. However, to study systematic, historical, complex forms of oppression, depending on the question you're asking, qualitative methods can be highly suited to giving a much more, you know, richly nuanced, richly textured, broad picture of what people, to me, it's like what the lived experience is, right? So we get from quantitative data, we can tell really important things. So the book that I'm the academic book I'm working on is how African American mothers and their teenage daughters talk to each other. And that wants to intervene in the conversation about racial and gender health disparities, right? Because we have all these really scary facts and figures about obesity, about diabetes, but until you understand just how do, at least in the group that I'm looking at, how do African American mothers navigate the healthcare system, which you can't necessarily get at just through statistics or quantitative work alone. You don't really have a sense of what doctors are saying to them, what they think about what their doctors are saying to them, how they then talk to their daughters about what doctors are saying to them or how they think about their own health. So it's really important to have, to me, a really broad and rich set of methodological tools. And Zora Neale Hurston was so wise and smart in learning ethnographic methods and then employing them to make visible hidden communities mm-hmm. or marginalized communities.
Yes, and we see that just with the preservation and the flourishing of her historic Eatonville. And so what does a festival like the Zora Festival really do in terms of furthering her legacy, furthering her connection to Afrofuturism, especially with the theme of this year's conference?
Well, this is a spectacular moment for the organizing committee, right? Because, so for example, myself, I would have loved to come to the Zora Neale Hurston Festival. I knew about it years ago and just could not get here. The fact that now Afrofuturism, because of its visibility in the wider culture, that's going to draw people in. And then even if people don't know anything about Zora Neale Hurston, that allows for the next kind of a layering of her work that just wouldn't be possible, right? I mean, I can't think of any other theme that, particularly for, you know, African American folks and even the broader community, that is so speaks to the moment that we're in. So I think that having this long-standing commitment to Afrofuturism is just going to bring in also more creatives, or people who identify as creatives, bring in more, you know, young people who really kind of see themselves as wanting to do big things, right? And if we can remind people of how big Zora Neale Hurston's legacy really is and couple that with Afrofuturism, I think that it really is a ripe moment for many, many communities to get engaged.
Yes, and since we are running a little bit close to your reading time, my last question, what will you be talking about today, later in your reading, and what do you think that future generations of Black thinkers can really learn from contemporary Afrofuturists and Zora Neale Hurston herself? Mm-hmm.
So I'm on a panel in just a few minutes about what is Afrofuturism, and I would like the panelists to drill down a little bit more about how they came to that, their own understanding of it, how it's maybe being used in a marketing sense that may or may not serve more liberatory purposes. And then I'm on a panel on women in Afrofuturism, and I'm going to be talking about some of the things that we share here about what kinds of narratives it helps us to see that aren't reflected in more speculative fiction. And then the last part of your question was about the kind of connection to Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah, so what do you think Black thinkers or future generations of Black thinkers can really learn from her?
Oh my goodness, a couple of things. So she has a very famous quote that says, research is formalized curiosity and you have to go poking and prodding. And I think that's really important, that to not be dull, and by dull I mean not be anesthetized by culture, right? Because Zora Neale Hurston was always curious about everything and everyone around her, and that's how you come up with new ideas. And her persistence, you know, I think as a creative person, she models for us. You know, she had patrons. She worked with literary giants in her era. she found ways to support herself, you know, way before, like, we think about, like, indie writers and self-published writers. She was doing all of that. And she fought for her right to be at the table. And I think that's a really important thing for us as well, to recognize we deserve to be at the table, we have really important ideas, and to be persistent in our creative work, and to push back on status quo thinking.
Thank you so much for speaking with me, Dr. Berger.
Thank you so much for this interview.
All right.